This is The Best of Our Knowledge, a presentation of National Productions.
How free is free speech on America's college campuses? There are many schools in the U.S. that seriously restrict speech and expression, and there are some that feel it's leading to a less tolerant society.
One university had a policy against, quote-unquote, inappropriately directed laughter.
Today on The Best of Our Knowledge, we'll hear from a First Amendment lawyer about the state of free speech on campus. We'll also hear how the number of women graduating with science degrees is leading to a rise in the number of women in the lab. And we'll spend an academic minute finding out just what they're looking at in those labs. I'm Bob Barrett, and this is The Best of Our Knowledge. According to our next guest, for over a generation, shocking cases of censorship at America's colleges and universities have taught students the wrong lessons about living in a free society. Drawing on a decade of experience battling for freedom of speech on campus, First Amendment lawyer Greg Lukianoff reveals how higher education fails to teach students to become critical thinkers in his book, Unlearning Liberty, Campus Censorship and the End of American Debate. In his book, he walks readers through the life of a modern-day college student from orientation to the end of freshman year. Lukianoff is an attorney and president of the Foundation for Individual Rights in Education. He spoke with The Best of Our Knowledge's Joe Donahue about how he became concerned with censorship on campus.
Well, I always had an interest in freedom of speech. I got it from both having parents from different backgrounds, so I realized they would have different ideas of what speech should be banned, and so it suddenly made perfect sense that the government should not be taking sides in a fight between my mom and my dad. But I went to law school, I went to Stanford, and I specialized in freedom of speech law because of my experience both growing up and with people from different cultures, and also from being a student journalist. Because if there's one thing that journalists get very, very quickly, is it doesn't matter if someone claims a restriction on speech is well-intended. They will always claim a restriction on speech is well-intended. It harms journalists first. So I specialized in that in law school. And I knew that, you know, Stanford could be a little bit ridiculous at times, and they did go to court to defend their speech code back in 1995, but I didn't really know how bad it was until I became the first legal director of the Foundation for Individual Rights in Education. I would later become the president of the organization in 2006, and the kind of cases that I saw, even though I studied First Amendment law, even though I was a big fan of the history of freedom of speech, I was not prepared for the kind of cases that I see on a daily basis at FIRE.
When you talk about speech codes, what does that mean? What does that term mean?
Speech codes is a broad term to refer to the fact that a lot of universities pass codes that wildly restrict freedom of speech in ways that, when they're challenged in a court of law, pretty much get laughed out of court. And, you know, actually, it's funny I should say laughed out of court, because an example I've come back to quite a bit was that Drexel University in Philadelphia had a policy against, quote-unquote, inappropriately directed laughter. And so many of these policies, you know, they talk about any expression that creates vague sense of unease, expression that is offensive anywhere on university campus. At one university, banning speech that is offensive in the sole discretion of the university. And the thing about these codes is they are so broad and they are so vague that literally every single student at a university can potentially be found guilty under these codes, because all of us have insulted someone at some point. All of us have offended somebody at some point, and that's why they get laughed out of court. But nonetheless, universities think that by passing these codes, they're somehow doing a good thing.
When it comes to the enforcement of these codes, is that being done? Looking at the book, it seems you give several examples of where that's being done.
Yes, absolutely. I open up the book talking about a student who was literally kicked out of his public college for criticizing a parking garage. It's a case that I can't really do justice to in a short amount of time, but this guy is a decorated EMT, believer in nonviolence. He made fun of a parking garage using a collage, and he was kicked out of school. Then that's one of the things that comes up time and time again, is sometimes it's true, it can be something more about political correctness. You do have the situation at Tufts where a conservative newspaper during Islamic Awareness Week wrote an advertisement that quoted from the Quran and said things about how the countries that punish homosexuality by death are Islamic theocracies, which is true. At the time, there are only Islamic theocracies, and only something like 4% of Saudi Arabian women are allowed to drive or something like that, but all verifiable facts. And they were found guilty of racial harassment because these verifiable facts made people uncomfortable. And then, of course, there's the absolutely absurd case that I've brought up many times, but it bears repeating. In Indiana, again, a public college bound by the First Amendment, where a student was reading a book called Notre Dame versus the Klan. It's about the defeat of the Klan and a 1924 march on Notre Dame. And it had a picture of the rally on the cover, of the rally when they tried to march on Notre Dame. And he was found guilty of racial harassment just because the picture on the cover made students uncomfortable.
Without, and I realize this question will seem cynical to many, and I don't mean it that way, but when you look at higher education, are these codes, these speech codes that you write about, are they more enforced in sectors of the campus that do not bring in a lot of money? In the sense of, would you see this same thing in regards to a sports program that brings in a lot of money? Would you see this same amount of concern over one particular course development or program that brings in a lot of money to the campus?
It's a very interesting question, and I have to go back to what my answer is on an awful lot of stuff. It's a real mixed bag. And the funny thing is, when it comes to like the rights of student-athletes, you know, FIRE recognizes that student-athletes agree to give up some amount of autonomy by agreeing to be a student-athlete. They're on a free ride. They usually have contracts, all that kind of stuff. But going to a program where you have professionals talking about how they have people on staff just to follow what student-athletes were putting on their Facebook posts and what they were tweeting about was really, that crossed into sort of creepy territory for me. So in some cases, the biggest money makers of all are the ones they police the most. In other instances, you'll have these small community colleges like Catawba University in North Carolina, where a student was definitely suspended. I think he was actually kicked out for publicly criticizing the school's overly cozy relationship with a credit card company. And the funny thing about fighting community colleges in some cases is that when you bring these cases up into when you do a press release about these cases, a lot of times the universities will kind of shrug their shoulders and say, they'll just wait for you to sue them. So it's really a very funny mixed bag. And to me, it comes down, in a lot of cases, just to, in some cases, the eccentricities of individual personalities who are in charge.
Looking at a broader picture, mm-hmm. when you consider our current state of discourse in this country,
yep.
do you believe that this censorship mm-hmm. has any input into how things are going now?
I absolutely do, and that's probably the most sort of ambitious hypothesis of the whole book, because speech codes have been around on campus for about, since the 1980s. And my point is not that higher education is by itself responsible for the low state of discourse and our political polarization, but that it's our best potential remedy for that. I believe that we're polarized for all sorts of interesting reasons that a lot of sociologists have speculated on that have to do even with the fact that we live in neighborhoods where we tend to agree with people. We move to towns that are more like-minded, and we've done so increasingly over the past 20 years. That being said, higher education could be a place where we would teach people across philosophical, religious, personal divides to be able to talk to one another. But that process is utterly short-circuited if people have to think twice about what they say.
When it comes to your optimism, do you feel this will always be an issue?
You know, it's funny because I definitely see a lot to be optimistic about in the world in general. But I do think that there are some dangers of society that's maybe just a little bit too comfortable. And one of them is that people start expecting sort of things to be comfortable all the time. And I think that our society, we're not being taught the value of freedom of speech, and that there is actually a value in having, for example, discussions that make you uncomfortable. And if we're not willing to actually understand that the requirements of democratic citizenship do mean that every so often you're going to have to go outside of your comfort zone if you really want to learn something, then we're in trouble.
Does it trouble the students? Do they realize it walking into it? We have sort of a before and after. Do students realize it?
You know, I don't really think the students know that there's a problem. I remember someone saying to me, it's kind of like, well, my children seem to have no problem with their college. I'm like, yeah, but I'm willing to bet that they do keep their mouth shut around professors that they know disagree with them. I'm willing to bet that they probably tend to talk to people they already agree with. And they haven't absorbed that great intellectual habit that, you know, has fallen by the wayside these days that all educated people should aspire towards, which is seeking out the intelligent person you disagree with. That's one of the things that higher education should be and could be teaching us today. And I think we'd be living in, frankly, a much more interesting, much more lively, much less tedious society if that was considered to be a great value.
Greg Lukianoff is a First Amendment lawyer and president of the Foundation for Individual Rights in Education. He spoke with the best of our knowledge's Joe Donahue. Coordinated strategies can help colleges and their communities protect students from the harms of high-risk drinking. Wally Akinzo from the National Institutes of Health has a report.
Strategies that address alcohol availability, alcohol policy enforcement, and drinking norms can help colleges and communities reduce alcohol-related harm to students. These coordinated strategies were part of the study to prevent alcohol-related consequences known as SPARC. Dr. Ralph Hinkson, an expert on alcohol prevention at NIH, explains the purpose of SPARC.
The purpose of this study was to assess the effectiveness of a multi-component college community collaborative intervention to reduce high-risk drinking and negative consequences from drinking.
Risks and consequences associated with drinking can include car accidents, DUIs or DWIs, the need for medical treatment as a result of drinking, physical fights, and sexual assaults. Dr. Hinkson says the study examined environmental approaches that had shown promise in communities but had not been thoroughly studied on college campuses.
What they did was they selected 10 universities in North Carolina and match them according to their size and their readiness to engage in activities to prevent these drinking problems, and then randomly allocated half of them to receive the intervention.
Within five campuses in the intervention group, many strategies were similar. Dr. Hinkson says there was a focus on specific areas of intervention.
Reducing the availability of alcohol, minimizing harm from alcohol misuse, altering social norms, and increasing alcohol price and restricting marketing. And then specifically within the schools, the most common interventions were restricting provision of alcohol to underage and intoxicated students, coordinating campus and community police enforcement, restricting alcohol purchase and possession, restricting alcohol at campus events. They implemented consistent disciplinary actions for alcohol policy violations.
For 3 years, researchers surveyed students about their drinking habits and resulting harms and found small but significant decreases in two categories.
Well, they didn't find significant changes with regards to drinking, but they did find significant reductions in consequences that those who misused alcohol experienced themselves. And they also saw a reduction in injuries to other people.
Dr. Hinkson believes that these modest reductions in harm will translate into many students being helped by the intervention. For example, a college campus with 11,000 students, researchers estimated the SPARC intervention will result in 228 fewer students experiencing at least one severe consequence of drinking over the course of a month, and 107 fewer students injuring others due to alcohol use during the year. He added that an important future step will be to focus on methods to promote adoption and implementation of the SPARC intervention in colleges across the U.S. For more information on the SPARC intervention, visit niaaa.nih.gov. This is Wally Akinso.
Still to come, more women are graduating with degrees in science, and that means there are more women in the lab. That's next on The Best of Our Knowledge. Got any questions or comments about The Best of Our Knowledge? Send them in. Our email address is knowledge@wamc.org. And if you'd like to listen to this or any past shows again, you can find us online at our flagship station's website. Just go to wamc.org and click on the programs link. You can start your own archive with a CD copy of the program. Call toll-free 800-323-9262. Be sure to ask for The Best of Our Knowledge, number 1160. This is The Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Bob Barrett. The number of women with advanced degrees in science and medicine have significantly improved over the past 50 years. A recent report from the Association of American Medical Colleges indicates that the number of female division chiefs, department chairs, and deans has increased overall by more than 50% in the past 10 years. In the July 2012 issue of the journal Clinical Chemistry, Dr. Shannon Hammond, director of the clinical laboratory at Children's Memorial Hospital, Northwestern University Feinberg School of Medicine in Chicago, posed a series of questions to a multi-generational panel of female clinical chemists who related their experience as women in laboratory medicine over the past several decades. I spoke with Dr. Hammond recently and asked if the work climate has changed significantly for women in the lab over the past several decades.
Well, my co-moderator, Amy Sanger, and I were actually seated at a dinner table with Marilyn Hustis, who's one of our panelists, and we were discussing various things, but we started to comment about the number of female role models and leaders in our field. And Amy and I were actually saying that we felt clinical chemistry was a good fit for women scientists because we know a number of successful females in the field that are somehow balancing a career and a family. So we asked Marilyn if she also felt that way throughout her career. And as the conversation continued, we agreed that this was something we would investigate and like to pursue as a Q&A feature for clinical chemistry. So we approached Dr. Nader Rafai about it, and he was extremely supportive of the idea and offered some ideas for panelists, and we took it from there. And we thought it would be important to have a multi-generational panel because we were interested to see if there would be similarities and or differences in the ladies' experience. And we received overwhelming enthusiasm from our panelists to first participate, and then we were really humbled by the candidacy of their responses. They answered openly and honestly, and we really appreciated that. These women have been leaders in the field and have achieved numerous awards and recognition throughout their careers. And so we hope that readers enjoy this feature and are inspired by their experiences and thoughts and the thoughts that our panelists shared.
Well, let's get into some of the meat of the article. How has the work climate changed for women in clinical chemistry over the past several decades?
I would say that it has improved drastically. That was reflected by many of our panelists' responses. And in our background research, we identified numerous reports and articles describing positive trends for women in math, science, and engineering fields. Of particular interest was the Association of American Medical Colleges report that showed the number of female leaders in academic centers has actually increased by over 50% in the past 10 years. And AACC itself has had strong present representation of female leaders, including most recently three consecutive female presidents. The members of our panel were also among the first female presidents of various international professional societies. And so for women in my generation, these types of accomplishments transform the question of if or can I do that to how do I get there? And so I definitely think the expectations and realities of what can be achieved have certainly been elevated for women of today's generations. I also think an important point made by Drs. Hustis and Horvath was that societal norms have also changed in a way that's supportive to those early in their career that have families, which enables them to be more productive at both work and at home.
Doctor, you asked the panelists to describe the lessons learned and significant achievements of other women in the field. What did you learn from their responses?
I learned that these women learned how to be successful from both women and men, as they often had male role models and mentors who valued contributions of males and females alike. Additionally, I found value in the comments related to conducting yourself in a professional and assertive yet respectful manner, and that it's very important to gain respect of your peers through performance and collaboration. Ultimately, the women before these women pushed the limits of what others thought possible and brought about change through hard work and talent. And so this is what's helped to raise expectations and opportunities for the next generation of female scientists.
You said the panelists were candid, and they really were describing the choices they've made throughout their careers and the realities of balancing a career and personal life. Was there a common theme to their stories?
I think that I learned we're all alike in that we sometimes struggle with the choices made throughout our careers and personal lives, and that there is no one correct answer to balancing work and family. Each person has to find what works for their personal situation, But a key point made by one of the panelists was that consideration and awareness of your own circumstances are key to setting and achieving realistic goals. And without this, you can wind up frustrated and in a very negative place. All of the panelists described a type of support system that was integral to their ability to manage their personal life and to also feel encouraged to continue their work and achieve their potential. Some had outside help while others relied on spouses for support. And a common point made was that success in your personal life reciprocates in your professional life. So achieving a work-life balance is significant.
Well, finally, Doctor, let's look ahead. What future opportunities will exist for women in clinical chemistry?
There will be numerous opportunities for women in clinical chemistry. As the panelists described, rapid advancements in technologies leading to novel biomarker discoveries and also a need for leadership in untapped areas of clinical chemistry. Additionally, as the profession expands its consultative role, skills such as communicating effectively, multitasking with efficiency, and organization will become increasingly important. These are often the same skills that are required for effective work-life balance. And as I said before, the number of females in math, science, and engineering leadership position continues to increase. So the next generation of women scientists will undoubtedly seek such positions.
Dr. Shannon Haymond is the director of the clinical laboratory at Children's Memorial Hospital, Northwestern University Feinberg School of Medicine in Chicago. You can read her article on this topic in the July 2012 issue of the journal Clinical Chemistry. So just what's going on in those clinical laboratories? That's the topic of today's Academic Minute.
Welcome to the Academic Minute. I'm Lynn Pascarella, president of Mount Holyoke College. Because they reproduce so quickly, bacteria are an important experimental tool for evolutionary biologists. Zachary Blunt, postdoctoral researcher at Michigan State University's Beacon Center for the Study of Evolution in Action, discusses how biologists have observed bacteria evolving entirely new functions and capabilities.
At our lab, we were able to examine the step-by-step process by which E. coli bacteria evolved to supplement a traditional diet of sugary glucose with an extra course of tangy citrate. These bacteria evolved during Richard Lenski's long-term evolution experiment with E. coli. This experiment began in 1988 and has allowed scientists to study more than 56,000 generations of bacterial evolution in action. Samples of the bacterial populations are frozen every 500 generations, and the bacteria in these samples remain alive. Think of it as a frozen fossil record that contains whole, living organisms. So when something interesting evolves in the experiment, scientists can go back to earlier generations and figure out the steps along the way. This allowed us to figure out that the ability to eat citrate evolved through three stages. The first was potentiation, during which E. coli accumulated at least two mutations that set the stage for later events. In the second, actualization, at least one more mutation allowed the bacteria to start eating citrate, but just barely. In the final stage, refinement, mutations were accumulated that greatly improved the ability to eat citrate, allowing the bacteria to wolf down their new food source and to dominate the population. We were particularly excited about the actualization stage. The mutation it involved was not a simple change of a letter in the bacteria's DNA. Instead, duplication of a part of the bacterial DNA rewired some genes and created a new regulatory module that had not existed before. The new module allows the bacteria to make a transporter that can bring citrate into the cell when oxygen is present. This is a new trick for E. coli, and the three stages by which it evolved are likely the same ones involved in the evolution of any new trait, meaning that studying this new trick in a humble bacterium has shed light on how all life has evolved.
That was Zachary Blunt of Michigan State University. You can find this, other segments, and more information about the professors on our website, academicminute.org.
Production support for the Academic Minute comes from Newman's Own Foundation in partnership with Mount Holyoke College. That's all the time we have for this week's program. If you'd like to listen again, join us online at our flagship station's website. Go to wamc.org and click on the programs link. And if you have any questions or comments about the program, send them in. Our email address is knowledge@wamc.org. I'm Bob Barrett. Be sure to join us next time for another edition of The Best of Our Knowledge.
Bob Barrett is producer of The Best of Our Knowledge. Dr. Alan Shartok is executive producer. The Best of Our Knowledge is a production of WAMC Radio's National Productions, which is solely responsible for its content. Hear more at WAMC.org.